Welcome to Highway to Health. I'm Jeremy Quinby. Thank you for tuning in. It is the third day of summer as I record this. Beautiful outside today, finally. We've had a bit of a rainy stretch, but I think we needed it. So nice to get the summery feel back. Everybody seems to be in good spirits everywhere I walk around this morning. I'd like to give a shout out to my family and friends and clients who have been so supportive of this project and who continue to send me positive feedback and encouragement. I've gotten so many nice messages and emails over the past couple weeks, and I just want you to know I'm very grateful to have you in my life and for all of your support. Today on the show, I've got Grant Earnhardt, and I'll tell you more about him in a second. But before that, I have to let you know that Highway to Health podcast is now on Spotify. So if you're at work or in your car and you get tired of listening to music and want something more engaging to get you through your workday or for your commute, you can switch over and listen to us there. You can type in Highway to Health and add podcast in the search bar on Spotify. There is a song titled Highway to Health, so make sure that you're in the right place. Maybe I should see if they'll let me include the song in the show at some point. If you are interested in helping support the podcast financially, you can go to our Patreon page. It's patreon.com/highwaytohealth. My guest for today's show is Grant Earnhardt. He's a former colleague, still a colleague, I guess. he's a friend and colleague. We used to work in the same place together. His office happens to be next door to my new office, so it's great that he's so close by. And we've had lots of great conversations over the years. And he's been here maybe 2 or 3 years at this point, recently transplanted back to Minneapolis since spending time in Boulder and San Francisco. He's a former world-class athlete and got into rolfing as a means of kind of studying self-care, I think, to some extent, and really, really got into the model. And we talk about it in this podcast. And we don't really talk so much about what rolfing is. So just quickly, it's a form of manual therapy that tends to work on sort of deeper patterns of fascia, and they're sort of known for their 10 series. But you know, these are models that we use to some extent because we try to get as close to what we think is happening. And Grant has some differing opinions about what might actually be happening in this. And he still uses the rolfing model, so he considers himself a rolfer. But he also thinks there might be something a little bit more curious and deep going on with people in this therapeutic relationship, and I think it's worth the listen. We really kind of riff for a little while here in this podcast because we've both worked in the world of chronic pain and working and around orthopedic challenges, and I think there's a lot here to discover. If you don't have any experience in having body work done, I think it could be a real informative thing for you. And even if you do, and you're kind of trying to figure out what to do for some challenge you're having, whether it's from an injury or just simply aging, I think there's some good stuff in here. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Grant Earnhardt.
For me lately, the idea of manual therapy, it's all about the nervous system.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So as you probably know, being a rolfer,
you're in my camp now.
Yeah. Yeah. I still touch people like a rolfer,
yeah,
which would be the classic rolfing idea is that we're changing, at least as it was told to me. And I went to school back starting in 1998, then 2000, yeah, and finished 2002. And as it was sort of given to me, it was the idea that I'm going to work on this person to think about their postural imbalance. And knowing anatomy, I'm going to take that knowledge and I'm going to use my hands to affect their fascia.
Right.
To alleviate and change these patterns so that they can stand differently, have less pain, have more comfort, have more personal awareness. And really, like, the holy grail for us was like understanding fascia, learning fascia. It's all about the fascia. And I was sort of like, even in school, it just was like a hard pill for me to swallow. I had a lot of questions about it.
Yeah.
I've always been kind of a questioning person. I had a lot of questions about really how is that possible? How can this work? But I tried it for a long time and got sort of disillusioned, actually. Went to art school in San Francisco instead.
What were you trying that you were disillusioned by?
Well, I just didn't believe the theory.
Okay. Within the sort of structural integration Rolfing?
Yeah, I think paradigm? At the time, it was about Rolfing because that's really what my experience was, my training was. It wasn't about manual therapy in general. But now I would extend that to all sort of, and I don't want to sound so sacrilegious, but I will extend that to pretty much the majority of manual therapy.
Yeah.
I don't think it works in the way that we have been told it does.
I think you're onto something.
Yeah. It doesn't mean it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And that's where people get really angry when you have these conversations with them, especially when you try to talk to people who've been doing this for their livelihood for a long time.
Yeah. Especially if they're connected to a brand or if they've made a brand for themselves. Yeah.
Absolutely. And that can get us down another road, which I think is really interesting, and we'll talk about in a second, but let me finish my thought. It's just that people get really upset because I think in that message of saying, I've come to this conclusion that it's not the theory that I was told, that I think it works by some other means. Mm-hmm. People hear you saying it doesn't work. And I've never said, actually, we're not getting change or it's not working. And my clients would agree that it's working. All I'm saying is the explanatory model is maybe not right.
Yeah.
And manual therapy is like rife with anecdotal evidence. And that's kind of like the wormhole I went down. It was hard for me to believe that I can touch someone's skin and through my elbow or my knuckles or my fingertips, I'm going to deform their fascial tissue in such a way that it will help either give length, like physically my pressure will do that. That's right. Going to lengthen it or break up adhesions, which by the way, there's no proof that there really are fascial adhesions, that
right.
Nothing that I've read. And
so let's get into this for anyone who might hear this and is wondering about what is fascia, because this is like our everyday language, but I agree with you on this. It's really interesting. And I have this conversation a lot with people about how, I mean, we can look at how we think we are manipulating different kinds of tissue. Right. But the reality is that, especially with fascia, it's enervated. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, when it comes down to that kind of stuff, how does the nervous system, you know, perceive what's being done to it? There's the autonomic part of the nervous system, right? But then there's the person on the table, the bigger person, we'll call it,
right.
You know, and how they receive you, you know, in different ways.
I think
ways.
That's a big piece of it, Jeremy. I mean, yeah. I think that's partly why people get upset when you talk about this in this way, is because I've been around and I've participated in a lot of conversations where people say, what I'm saying, or my friends who are really, you know, there's sort of these different camps that are popping up now, like saying, maybe it's not fascia within my world of Rolfing or within structural integration. Maybe it's this model. And when people say, toss out an alternate plausible explanation for what it's happening, then the old timers or people who've been doing it for a long time, they say, what do you mean it doesn't work? I've been doing this for 40 years and it works.
Yeah.
When I put my hands on someone, I feel it changing. I feel the body change.
Yeah.
And I say, yeah, I do too.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you know it's fascia?
Yeah.
You can't see in there.
Right.
You can't cut in there. If you cut in there, of course you could never know.
Right.
You can't know. And science, there's more and more studies that come out and say, it's not that plausible that fascia changes with physical force, with physical deformation.
Yeah.
But yet, in structural integration and other great manual therapies, we see people get out of pain. We see people move differently. We see people stand differently, sit differently, relate to themselves differently. What is that about?
Yeah. It's really interesting too, because I've had a conversation just recently with an older orthopedic surgeon who wants to come get treated by me and has never had craniosacral therapy, but seems completely open to the idea, mm-hmm. especially after I've kind of explained the model to him a little mm-hmm. bit more. And I was telling him about an article that I read about how the orthopedic world is taking a different view on fascia, mm-hmm. in that most likely we were fascia, the embryonic state,
right.
is the fascia in Latin, for anyone listening, means glue. Mm-hmm. It's turned into fascia when it's on the front of a house. Yeah, I'm not exactly sure why, but you know, it's actually not just two dimensional either. And this is the way that I feel like somehow in the way that I've heard people in Rolfing talk about it sometimes. I mean, this could mm-hmm. all be in how it's been received by the student, but I think it's because it goes to the depths of our dural membrane system and our around our organs and all these different things. Mm-hmm. It is, you know, what I was saying to this guy is what's being suggested is that maybe everything just grows into fascia, you know, mm-hmm. and in a way it's like, some people will say this, it's kind of our second brain, or it is just that we like to really pin everything down to the way information is stored as if it's all in a container like our head, mm-hmm. but that it's actually happening all over the body. There's memory response and all these different things. And that's another thing that's sort of hard for people to understand. But this guy said, I can buy that.
That, you mean memory could be related to fascia somehow.
Or that because the way we think about from an orthopedic perspective of that everything's attaching to the firm structure of bones, right? Because mm-hmm. we think about it in terms of architecture, mm-hmm. but a body is not an architectural piece mm-hmm. that's built from the ground up that way. We are initially floating, right?
Right. I don't know. I mean, when I think about this piece, the idea of like, or like, why do I no longer really feel that it's about the fascia? Mm-hmm. Is because when you look through an anatomy book, you know, like at Rolfing School or maybe other manual therapies, you flip through kind of a bunch at the beginning, like skip a bunch of plates, and you get to the ones about bones, muscles, fascia.
Yeah.
Ooh, connective tissue. Yeah. That's it. That's our juice.
Right, right.
Okay. Now, 16 years later, I've been studying a lot of chronic pain science. A lot of these guys like Lorimer Moseley and David Butler out of the NOI group in Australia. Really interesting work about what they call the biopsychosocial model of pain, mm-hmm. and how a lot of times we can have pain, maybe residual pain from a site that's healed. So tissue should be fine, but we still have chronic pain there.
Mm, yeah.
So from studying with those guys, I start to think more about nervous system. Like, okay, what's the involvement of the nervous system? Crack open an anatomy book to start looking at stuff. And it just hit me one day. I opened it up at the beginning, all these plates I used to skip. And what do I see there? I see a human form primarily covered in all yellow. Mm. Now, for those people who don't really understand, who haven't looked at anatomy books much, yellow is like the color of the nervous system. And what that told me is that all these years that I've been saying I'm affecting fascia, what I realized is there's no way I could affect fascia without first eliciting response in that person's nervous system.
Right.
Absolutely no way. And so I feel like Ida Rolf had a really great theory. And I don't mean her any disrespect. She's a brilliant person. She gave us really cool work that can help people change their lives, their relationship to their body and their pain. However, I think from my own personal experience of working with people over the years, I don't feel like I can really affect fascia, but I know I can affect nervous system. I can mm-hmm. I know I can help the person experience themselves in a more clear way, which when I compare that, when I bring that into my understanding of pain science now, we have things called body maps, and they can be a smudge. And if there's in our homunculus, if that body map of that sense of ourself isn't clear, more than likely people can be more sensitive to pain and discomfort.
Right.
So what about if it's not about fascia, but it's about that interplay with my touch, my words, helping this person relate and get a new relationship to how they sense and think about themselves.
Yeah.
And clarifying things like these body map and movement patterns through touch and through words, that really elicits the change.
Yeah.
And that's it. To me, that lands true.
Yeah.
Both in my ideology and in my experience in practice.
Yeah. It rings true for me too. And the, you know, we start out with some kind of model, right? Like we have to, and I even would say this about lots of different things that I've studied because I do movement-based work and mm-hmm. body work. I'm kind of looking I struggle with both of these, mostly because in the 20 plus years I've been doing this now, there's a lot of branding going on. This is one thing to remember too, is that we're working in a huge field now. From the financial perspective, it's now a big money maker to be in holistic therapies.
Absolutely.
And so the businesses have risen to meet the demand of therapy.
Yeah. People have to carve out territory.
Yeah. But I think like I haven't studied directly Ida Rolf, but mm-hmm. I've looked at a lot of different fascial models and, mm-hmm. and certainly that stuff comes up and I've just because I've been curious about the difference between how Rolfing versus the structural integration approach, which is
they're the same,
very similar, right? I mean,
structural integration is really like we consider it the blanket terminology for kind of all the different schools and modalities that essentially have risen out of Ida Rolf's original ideas.
Yeah. And I think maybe because some people say they're an SI therapist now.
Well, that's because
are they trying to distance themselves?
To do with when Ida Rolf passed away, there actually was a split between her students.
Mm.
Yeah. So ideological split. And as I understand it, because I wasn't around when that happened, that was like, I think in the early 80s or so. I should know my Rolfing history, but I don't. But it happened sometime in the early 80s. And so, you know, she had given this idea into the world.
Yeah.
And she had started to teach it to people. And it really affected people's lives in positive ways. And so her students were, of course, really passionate about these ideas and what they had been learning and furthering the work on their own.
Yeah.
But when she passed away, the sort of guiding light was gone. And her students were left to like figure out on their own, like, well, what do we do with this? Is this a perfect work? That's just, we have, because when she taught it, as I understand it, at the very beginning, it was very methodical, very much, we call it a recipe today, and we don't use it, at least I don't use it in the same way that she taught it, because I went to the Rolf Institute. Let me back up, because when the school split, when her students split, they've quick formed two schools.
Hmm.
One was called the Rolf Institute.
Yeah.
And the students in
which is where?
Boulder, Colorado.
Boulder, okay.
And then the students who kind of created that school trademarked her name quickly and first, and they could be called Rolfers. And they're the only people, you have to go to the Rolf Institute to be called a Rolfer.
Okay.
And it's a legal thing. And their sort of ideology around it was that, look, she gave us this fantastic idea and this great work. We need to teach the 10 sessions in the spirit of Ida Rolf, but we need to further the work. So they kind of distilled these ideas of principles, Rolfing principles. The other faction was a group that said, no, this is the work. What she taught us is the work. And as I understand the way that she taught her students at the time was really very methodical, like three passes down the back.
Yeah.
Five passes here or there, you know, on the sole of the foot, like really like taking her by hand.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think, and that second group of students formed something called the Guild of Structural Integration.
Okay.
So now any other school that kind of riffs on the Rolfing model, they can't be called Rolfers, but they could call themselves structural integrationists or Rolfing in the, structural integrationists in the Rolf method or something like that.
Gotcha.
I mean, it's this legal
ease
that, you know, muddies everything else further, but that's how it is.
And it's these people who are, you know, real, you know, path pavers, you like Joseph Pilates. I hear the same thing in the Pilates community that, you know, there's a lot of the same kind of discord going on there because of, you know, the word of these people was everything. And yet I think they were trying to bring something new to the masses. And one of the easiest ways to do that is to really, you know, methodize the approach to start And, you know, maybe if we could have Ida Rolf in this conversation at this point, she might have a totally different view on what happened with her work as time
Absolutely.
Went on.
Absolutely. I think it's inevitable that she would weigh in.
Yeah.
And say, yeah, this sounds right. Or, oh, that's, you know, I'm by far not the biggest expert on Ida Rolf sayings and stuff, but I know that there's a lot of content that, you know, both sides use to say, no, it's absolutely about fascia, or, and then other people say, well, you know, at the time that she created her theories, we didn't know that, we didn't have functional MRIs to understand things as like the role of the homunculus and what role does that play in proprioception.
Can you describe the homunculus for?
Sure.
Are you pretty versed in it? Because
I just saw
one at a museum recently.
Yeah. No. So here's how I talk about it in my practice to people, because I bring in these ideas now that I've learned through pain science and from other sources, because I do think it's not about fascia all the time or ever.
Yeah.
We're making change in these tissues, but the practitioner, me and you, are like the catalyst that elicits change through our touch and through our words and ideas that the client can then take in. So in my practice, I talk to people, especially people with chronic pain. I say, look, research is starting to show us, and you can find David Butler and Lorimer Mosley, you can search for some of these ideas, and you can get information about it. But it's starting to show us that when we have long-term pain, so chronic pain, which is actually on the rise in a lot of Western cultures, we're not exactly sure why.
Yeah.
But it's on the rise, more and more chronic pain. Okay. One theory that we have about why chronic pain exists and kind of holds on is that there gets to be what's called a smudge in the homunculus. The homunculus, I tell people, is a part of your brain that, imagine you were wearing a headband, and it kind of sits right, and the headband's right on the top of your skull between your two ears. As I understand it, that's where the homunculus lives.
Okay.
And the homunculus, what it does is it's sort of every neuron of our body maps there. So because we have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of nerve receptors in our palms and the bottoms of our feet, those areas of the homunculus take up a larger portion of that space in our brain than, per se, our back, middle of our back.
Right.
Okay. And it's important for our body to have this system so that we can understand when we have a stimulus, when something's touching our skin or our body, that we know where it is.
Yeah. And most of them are our big sense organs, right? So if you look at the visual that you see with when they visualize the homunculus.
Exactly. Hands are gigantic.
He's got these gigantic hands, gigantic feet, big, huge lips. Yeah. Ears are a little bigger than normal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everyone, and I think nose is also a little bit, everyone expects the genitalia to be, you know, bigger, but they're actually smaller. We don't really sense that much from there.
Size doesn't matter, Jeremy.
It doesn't matter at all.
So what happens is I tell people, so it's important to have that really accurate sensing piece of our brain, so we know when things are touching us, when we're coming into contact with things. And it allows us to also have that sense of ourself in space without having to look.
Yes,
exactly. Proprioception.
Yes.
And I tell people that's the cool skill that lets you roll over in the middle of the night, grab that glass of water on the floor by the side of your bed, keep the lights off, bring it to your lips, drink, put it back down without spilling all over yourself and making a huge mess. That's proprioception at work. You don't see yourself, but you know where you are.
And the coordinating effort of all the senses, mm-hmm, that creates these almost kind of multiple senses that we
absolutely
we're having a hard time to define that, I think, because mm-hmm, it may not relate to like one thing. It's really all of them in coordination, or two of them in coordination, or something.
Yeah. And the cool thing, here's the interesting thing now, you know, just riffing on the homunculus a little bit more, I've quick talked about body maps and smudges.
Yeah.
But what seems to be coming out in some fairly recent evidence, I think, or studies, is that, and I'm going to borrow this analogy from this guy, David Butler, because I think it's the most clear and elegant analogy of this.
Yeah.
Remember those boxes full of sort of pins as a kid? You put your hand underneath the pins, and the pins where your hand, touch your hand, rise up.
Yeah, yeah.
You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And as he talks about it, he says, imagine that each one of those pins is like 10,000 neurons of information.
Yeah, yeah.
So if we put our hand underneath this pin box and our hand pushes those pins up, that only
makes the shape of the hand,
exactly,
sort of.
Exactly. Yeah, it right. makes the shape of our hand. And no other pins come up. That is what we would call a clean body schema,
okay.
a clean and clear body map.
Yeah.
But for some reason, sometimes you can get what's called a smudge. So maybe this time you put your hand underneath there and all the pins in your hand push up and make the outline of your hand. But maybe there's a couple errant pins in between some fingers. Maybe there's a clump not even close to your hand.
Yeah.
That would represent neurons that are being excited that don't really have anything to do with your hand. And in that example,
with the map,
exactly, with your map, that's an unclear map. That's called a smudge. Mm-hmm. And one of the theories is that when we have a smudge like that, the body, it's harder for the body to be really sure about the information it's getting and what part of the body is being informed.
Yeah.
And therefore, to keep us safe, it might interpret a potential threat. And erring on the side of safety, if there's a potential threat, then it seems like the nervous system creates pain.
Yeah. Or from what I've seen and early on in my career, the reason that I kind of shifted from doing more massage therapy to craniosacral work is that I could, let's say someone comes into you or with the back has gone out type mm-hmm. of thing, you know, which is usually that they have muscle spasms, mm-hmm. you know, and it sometimes it can be from, you know, an imbalance going on in the body where it's just kind of been pushed to a limit and all of a sudden everything just fires and stabilizes, right? Mm-hmm. It just protective response. But that doesn't have to happen for a physical structural reason either. It can right. happen for emotional reasons. It can happen for because of a traumatic event or some combination of stressors on that autonomic, you know, system where we've just that fight or flight response or that side of the system and all the, you know, stress hormones, everything that's related to that and how it affects the body just gets pushed to a limit and mm-hmm. all of a sudden probably creates maybe a smudge even in that.
Yeah, when you read about brain. Smudging, it's super interesting. Yeah. So smudging and clarifying are it's like they're always happening.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
One thing I read that said, if you take the three middle fingers of either hand, tape them together so it becomes like one big flipper paddle finger,
yeah.
It only seems like it takes about 4 hours for that to start to register in your homunculus as one piece.
Oh, that's interesting.
Right? So now imagine the clients who have had a neck brace for weeks or months.
Yeah.
Or some
arm in a sling.
Absolutely. Arm in a sling, crutches, any of those devices that help us heal.
Yeah.
But leave a little bit of a mark. So, you know, I mean, I think with movement is one way to get it back.
Yeah.
And maybe then also body work or other things. But, you know, what you talked about sort of starts to lead me down this idea of the biopsychosocial model of pain, the idea that maybe it's not always originating from the body. Maybe there's a component of the emotional piece or the relationship piece.
Mm-hmm.
The way that, as I understand pain science so far, is, and this is what I like about the model that Lorimer Moseley and David Butler and others are putting forward, and why it makes sense to me in my practice here, is I used to see people and I would only work on their biology.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes some people totally would shift, and other people it was a little shift, and other people it didn't shift. And it really frustrated me. And when I started to learn about this idea of biopsychosocial and the role of the nervous system in potentially sustaining a pattern of chronic pain, it was like a light bulb went on for me. It completed these pieces where I said, I'm getting people to change, but I don't believe it's by working with the fascia.
Yeah.
So what am I addressing? Gosh, maybe I'm somehow alleviating these people's nervous systems, or I'm helping them clarify a body map, or I'm helping them feel safe and comforted.
Mm-hmm.
And that opens up something within them that gives them some hope or some space to have a new relationship to the pain. So the biopsychosocial model would say, as an example, I use this in my office a lot, it's not always rooted in the biology. And that gets to your point a little while back saying, maybe it has to do with the stress response that's chronic.
Yeah.
And you're getting, you know, all this cortisol or in neuroscience, there's a saying, if it fires together, it wires together.
Right.
And I think that goes to explain a lot about how this biopsychosocial model works.
Yeah. And I always try to explain this to people who have sort of, especially depending on how long they've been living with something. I mean, I may get somebody who's, you know, fresh out of a car accident and
right.
knew they needed to get in and see me as soon as possible because they had some whiplash and that kind of stuff.
Yep.
But I may see somebody 10 years down the line who has also had, you know, knee surgery and then multiple other, you know, little things mm-hmm. go on physically, right? And so there are all these different patterning pieces. And the way I try to explain it to people is that the nervous system works really well. It's almost like with the homunculus, right?
Mm-hmm.
It wears grooves so to yep. make things easy. So
call
that
a
we
record
can,
groove.
Exactly. And it's, but, so it's, yeah. it's the reason that we can do certain things without having to think about it eventually. Like, you know, play guitar, your fingers just know the shape of the chord that you're playing or something, you know, something.
It has to be that way. Otherwise we wouldn't survive.
And because it would take too much energy for us.
Well, we'd have to relearn it every time.
Every single time.
Yeah, can you imagine trying to wake up every day and be like, how do I walk now? You know, how do I talk? How do I do anything? So yeah, we get those patterns.
So going back to the beginning of your career, you were an art student, correct?
No, the very, very beginning, I was a cross-country skier. I did the sport of biathlon, which is the Winter Olympic sport of skiing and shooting. And I actually was
a member. What level?
I did World Cups. I was a member of the U.S. national team for 2 years. And that's actually how I got into body work. I started
sense.
I started to understand, I want some recovery. I was looking for every legal edge, you know. I wasn't going to dope or anything like that, but if I could get more relaxation, or I could train a little bit harder by getting good massage, good body work,
yeah,
okay, I'll sign up for that. And that opened the door to different kinds of modalities of body work. And I ended up meeting these two women who I just really liked the way that they approached body work. And then I found that the thing that they had in common was that they were in the process to become rolfers. And I thought, what's rolfing? You know, that I think I'd heard about it once or twice before, and it sounded really painful. And then, but the way they worked was not painful.
Yeah.
And so I just, you know, bookmarked that in my mind, and then ended up sort of, I thought I was maybe going to be pre-med in college. And then I had some experiences that I decided I didn't want to do that, but I really, you know, being an athlete, I loved working with my body, and the body was so curious to me, like just, you know, it's just the most mysterious thing I've ever known. And so it was just like, here's a way to work with it, you know? And that was interesting and exciting. So that's how I got started down rolfing. And mm-hmm. I had time one spring, and actually I paid my deposit to go to the Rolf Institute in Boulder. And then a week later I found out I was named to the national team for biathlon. So it was a really exciting and kind of hectic period in my life, but it's, you know, it really went well together, because then I was able to take what I learned at the Rolf Institute and apply it to teammates and experiences. And
what did you do for college then? What was your major?
Well, my college road is a long and winding road. I think I started off thinking I was pre-med. Then I lived in Germany for a year, and I saw a different approach to health.
Yeah, yeah.
And I combined that with thinking I had a grandmother who died of Parkinson's, or dementia and Parkinson's, you know, comorbidity of those two. And when she passed away, she was just on like so much medication that it was really hard for me to believe that the medication didn't also play some role in her illness.
Yeah.
Not in her Parkinson's, but maybe her dementia, or just maybe in her, her being unwell. And I'm not knocking Western medicine. I believe that they help a lot of people, a lot of people. But I looked at that experience and I decided I didn't at that time want to be a part of that. I saw a model in the U.S. that seemed to be much more about medicating, versus in Germany when I was there for a year doing sports and, you know, being sick and being well, I saw different approaches, much more open to natural remedies, much more open to nutrition, much more open to
lifestyle.
Yeah, lifestyle. Things like saunas, you know?
Yeah,
like,
I think I had the same experience being in Europe for college, and then a friend of mine went to a grad program in Belgium. I ended up kind of going over there and getting to, you know, experience the lifestyle a little bit more.
Absolutely.
And it's not like they don't, you know, drink too much beer sometimes, but I feel like their day-to-day, their relationships, their work life, everything just, and just the even the spaces that they would create in their day for getting together in the middle of a work day for coffee. And
Sweden, they call it the fika.
Yeah. I mean, I've tried to bring some of that into my life, you know, here. Mm-hmm. I think being in New York for a while, there's enough Europeans around and enough European influence that some of it exists, mm-hmm. but you know, the work day is also like 18 hours long.
Yeah. I mean, I went to the opposite coast, you know, I relocate. So I finished Rolfing school in 2002, actually opened my first practice for a year in Duluth.
Okay.
And, during that time, I had aspirations to go to someplace near Seattle to maybe study in natural medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't do that. Kind of glad I didn't, just a different path. And I got turned on to art and photography. And the reason I feel like I got turned on to art and my creativity was through my actual experience of my Rolfing 10 series. But that could be another story. But that's what I got from my Rolfing experience, was like, wow, explosion of creativity. But anyhow, so I got into art, and I was already, had been working for a year, feeling kind of like not believing in the theory of what I was doing, not sure how to gauge success or failure with clients. And then photography came along and became this really amazing connection with the world everywhere around me. Let me ask questions I wanted to ask and interact with things and create things and make things. So I jumped at it and I moved to San Francisco. And so a similar kind of thing, as a big city, I had the real international feeling, and I really soaked that up too and enjoyed that. And I worked out there as a massage therapist for a long time while also having a Rolfing practice, and then finally just a Rolfing practice. And then
so when you started, did you kind of use a model to work with people, and how did that sort of shift and change, and how long did that take?
In some ways, that's what's kind of, you know, I tell people sometimes that I'm a sacrilegious rolfer. I'm sure some people would be really annoyed to say that, but because there's, I think, like I said at the very beginning, just because I say it might not be fascia doesn't mean what I learned doesn't work.
Yeah.
And so what I mean by that is, I still think there's an importance in at least riffing on or following fairly closely the 10 series that I learned in Rolf Institute from Ida Rolf. Just because it's not fascia, like I said, doesn't mean I'm not getting changes. I am getting changes. So I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to update the model. I mean, sometimes when I have these conversations about why is it important? One, I like the model I find that feels to be more empowering to the client. I say, you have a role in this too.
Yeah.
I'm giving you ideas. I'm giving you information through touch and through word and through sources to go and read about to help you empower your own change a little bit. I'll be your partner in it. I'll be your catalyst. But it's not like I have a special secret power to melt your connective tissue.
Yeah.
And so I like that empowering, that new idea of working, say, we're partners.
Mm-hmm.
But I still follow a 10 series because I think one of the things that, you know, we talked about the homunculus, I think what happens in Rolfing is over those course of 10 sessions, you help people consciously or unconsciously clarify the relationships in their body.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Here's how my arm relates to my shoulder, and here's how my shoulder relates to my ribs, or my shoulder relates to my hips. Oh, and I give people small little homework, small little mindfulnesses to think about in between sessions that have really big impact, I think. You know, a lot of people come and say, I can't believe I never thought of that on my own. And it's like, well, I, you know, I'm not a genius. I just had somebody else tell me, so now I can share it with you because it is useful.
And it's sort of how you engage with them in that process. Like, I think I've done this both in movement work and in body work, where, you know, with movement work, I was considered a trainer. I tried to get away from the idea of being a trainer because I think the stigma, for one, but it's also, I'm not here to be your babysitter in exercise. And I would kind of say the same thing about, you know, I never got drawn to the spa culture of doing body work. I don't want someone to come in and lay down on my table and just take a nap session after session. Every once in a while, if someone's been in a place and they just go there, fine. But ultimately, over time, we're working together with, you know, with something. And I think that homunculus map that we're sort of creating, you know, people, how many times have people said, like, I thought I was doing fine until you put your hands on this place, right?
Oh, it's so tight. I didn't even know.
I didn't even know, right? Yeah. And that's part of the mapping, is like, you know, this is where now the different people that I go to for work, sometimes I like the if I know what their work is about, I like the idea that they're going to kind of get in there and mm-hmm. and move some tissue around. But I also get a lot out of some people who do these like really long strokes, you know, massage mm-hmm. strokes, and they're not necessarily working as deep, but it's very intentional and there's kind of an energetic component and they're connecting, you know, hands between two places where I'm feeling relationships going on in my body and paying attention to those things, which is, you know, the most gentle version of that is kind of this craniosacral approach mm-hmm. where it, you know, if anyone watching it, you know, was to see what was going on, it's like watching grass grow. There's nothing, seemingly nothing mm-hmm. going on, but for the person on the table, mm-hmm. there can be a lot going on. And that part is that they are really tuning into that body mapping and this awareness that gets built. And I try to bring that into my, you know, movement sessions mm-hmm. too, so that what people are taking away is really this new, you know, this way of mapping and being able to kind of get a sense of themselves in space. That mirrors in the gym aren't going to give you, you know?
Yeah, no. Just seeing yourself doesn't mean that you're going to understand something new. Just because you watch yourself doesn't mean that, you know, I'm not a talk therapist and I don't want to give the impression that I do work in here like a talk therapist.
Right.
But working on somebody with my hands can be a similar experience on a kinesthetic mode.
Oh, for sure.
Right? It's yeah. like, you know, I touch somebody in their shoulder and it's sore, and then you touch someone and you move it and you find a different place and it's less sore. And then you have a conversation, you say, do you feel that? Can you bring your attention here to this place? Can you find this place? Ask for some movement as you're touching. There's a way that relationship yeah. is what unlocks the person to have a new yeah. understanding. I tell my clients this a lot. E.E. Cummings, the poet, has a quote.
I love E.E. Cummings.
Yeah, me too. He's, you know, when I first read him, it was like, whoa, I didn't even know it could be like this. But he has a book. It's called Six Non-Lectures. And I think it was a series of lectures he gave at Harvard or something. But in there, there's a nugget that, to me, I have told probably almost every client I worked with, because I think it is so applicable as to what we do yeah. in manual therapy. And the quote goes like this. It says, how can you know something that you've never been without? Never been without? And you know one thing I've never been without is my sense of myself. Hmm. I had to learn how to crawl.
Yeah.
I had to learn how to sit up. I had to learn how to walk. Those neural patterns have always been with me, just like my shadow. So to turn it in on yourself and really be clear and understand and explore that, I think it's very, very hard. It's like a coin trying to understand its two sides.
It's important to give to somebody that you're going to work with through a process too, because we are a culture of fix me a lot of times.
Absolutely.
Because there's a lot of victimization that goes on. And so people almost kind of hit a bottom a lot of times where they're just finally like, fix me. I can't deal with this anymore. Mm-hmm. But what we're really doing is, you know, trying to pull together all those parts that are this person, all the dynamic things that are this person, and put mm-hmm. them, you know, help them find all that together and build the strength back up in whatever is going on, whether it's physiological or emotional or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think giving them that from the start, I used to train body workers. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I would put a lot of effort into when I was starting training with them was, I want you to think about the session starting the minute that person walks in the door, even before that.
I would say, I think that session starts when they call you.
Yeah. But sometimes in the place that we were at this point, they didn't right. necessarily get to talk.
Yeah, sure.
For you and I, for sure. But
absolutely.
But you know, I want you to almost start imagining what this, you know, in hopefully a positive way, what right. this is going to be like in this relationship, and trust your instincts from the start. And that was the thing I noticed with a lot of people, is that if they didn't trust their instincts from the start, that was usually the part that caused that person coming in to sort of, you know, back up in getting involved in that mm-hmm. process.
And talk more about that. I mean, what do you mean following their instincts? You're talking about like as soon as the person, the therapist, as soon as they see the person, they should start to imagine like how they would work with the person, you mean? Or is it more, because I was thinking more like when, to me, like I think the first contact I have with a client, and this is what I thought you were talking to at first, but maybe something different, but the first contact I have with a client, so via email or phone,
yeah,
to me, that is context setting. Oh, that is teaching them about therapeutic relationship instantly.
Yeah.
And I think more important than any tool, any technique, what's most important to outcome for a client, positive outcome, is the richness of and safety that's felt in therapeutic relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. So maybe that's kind of what I'm getting at. In this situation that I was in, somebody else was taking scheduling, right? So they, because they're new therapists, and they weren't private, they were building their practice within, an establishment. Mm. But for you and I, that's always the case, is that it's that relationship building. But that's what I kind of wanted them to understand, is that the minute that you start working with them, it's starting to happen in dialogue and interaction, in your ability to listen to them and just be and just create that space for whatever they need. That's a hard thing to start with for some people. We're used to, I think controlling things a little bit more, or even getting in that fixer mode too much, you know. And when I think people are actually, we're trying to help them get involved in their process early on. I that's one of the things I'm always trying to do with my clients, is to understand that they don't necessarily need me, long term. That I'm here as part educator, partner through this process with my given skill set. Yeah. But I'm not going to do all the hard work.
That leads me to something that I've sort of thought about and maybe decided about in the last years, especially as I've started to really open up, like, what's happening here, and trying to think about that and question everything that I was told, the idea of guruism.
Yeah.
I just don't have interest in being a guru.
Yeah.
Because, again, like the approach that, well, first off, it's annoying to me when you are like paying money for a class, and then what I kept finding so often was like what was being given to me or conveyed to me was primarily anecdotal, an N equals one experience that this teacher was giving to me as if it was universally true with clients.
And
to me, that, and I'm not trying to knock all my teachers, I've had great teachers throughout the years too, amazing people. But there, I think in this work, because I think, to be honest, we do work in a field that's hard to really do quality studies on, scientific studies and research studies. It's hard to really qualify and quantify how does manual therapy work. I mean, people are trying to still figure that out. So because there is so much gray space, I think it's very easy to sort of fall into like pseudoscience. Yeah. I mean, I find we're always like walking that edge.
Yeah.
And that brings us kind of full circle around this whole conversation a little bit about, or at least to the very beginning, this idea of like, I think it's my duty to try to tell my clients, I'm a rolfer. I don't think it's about fascia anymore. That doesn't mean you're not going to experience some change. And I'm telling you this because I'm trying to be as up to date with the science and research as I can. And what I found is that really the better approach is to be partners and collaborators in this. Mm-hmm. And as long as I feel like as long as I take that tack, I will not fall into the camp of being somebody's guru. It won't be about my ego so much. Yes, it feels good when you help people. I like that feeling.
Right.
But
long-term, you're not going to help them. Right.
And long-term, I want to teach someone ideas about how to relate differently to themselves and to their struggle and their feeling and their pain.
Yeah. And I have the exact same thing. It's come up a few times on the podcast, but I had an experience with it early in my career where I was almost kind of ready to quit in some ways because I felt like everybody wanted me to be a guru.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure exactly what shifted for me, but I think there was a couple of solid decisions about, the expectation of what people were going to get from doing the work. Like it's
yeah, you know, it's heavy.
It's and because I had some teachers early on who sort of explained, you know, some things and how to deal with this with some people, because, you know, you can't make someone relax on a table.
Mm-mm.
You know, that's not, you know, you might have a few tricks, you know, you can tell them to breathe and do different kinds of things. But, you know, if someone's been sort of, you know, holding on to tension for some period of time, or if there's just a lot of ingrained stuff in their system,
mm-hmm.
you're not going to get that to happen, that change to happen in a session. Mm-hmm. And I think we, as helpers, we so want to make this thing happen that mm-hmm. we take all that on personally. And something shifted that I was able to kind of like step away from that and really early on get people involved in their own process.
That's
of,
cool. Yeah.
Of, you know, something that you said earlier, you know, of, I don't remember what the terms were, but basically it was your quote. Tell me the quote again.
E. Cummings, how can you know something that you've never been without?
There was another quote earlier from somebody else. Maybe I'll have to come back to it.
I have to find it.
But it was, I think it was from one of the Australian guys, but it was, you know, this idea that we are sort of in this, you know, everything is kind of in this container in some way that we're going to have to address in some way, which mm-hmm. is
if it fires together, it wires together.
Yeah.
And yeah. It's like a kind of a premise of neuroscience, I think.
And we're, you know, there's so much happening with any individual that we're going to continuously peel back layers of everything that's become ingrained in us. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to do the work.
Well, so that leads me to, I don't know if these quite qualify as platitudes, but the nuggets I give my clients, and it's really something, I forget where I read it, is I didn't come up with it again, but it has to do with this idea of collaboration and empowerment. And I tell clients, I said, look, here's the real truth about this. It's like, this can help you. I can be of help to you. However, I see you for 75 minutes once a week. That means you have 6 days and around 22 hours that I'm not seeing you. So what we try to do in here is we try to give your nervous system and your body and you consciously some new ideas. How does your parts and pieces relate? And then I'm going to give you some ideas about how to think about those ideas outside of my office, because you have to employ them. And here's a little nugget, because I tell people, if you put the same input in, you're more than likely going to get the same output out.
Yeah.
So when you're not in here, it's my job to have given you something to touch back on that can help you find new input to put in so that we can jog that output. But I can't do that for you. I can't
do it.
Right. And I tell people you should write post-it notes or do little things to help you remember. I try to like link the ideas of movement and awareness, because I do think a lot of what we teach people is how to really feel themselves and be aware. And I try to link these little activities to, like, you know, when you're brushing your teeth, think about this. When you're cooking your food, pay attention again to this kind of thing, so that it is the experience that happens in my office is somehow taken with you into your life and anchored out in your real life a little bit. You don't have to go to a special place to do it. No, you do it at home. But you got to put different input to get different output.
Yeah.
You got to.
And those little cues, I think, are very important to sort of send people away with. But mm-hmm. even just what you were talking about of, I mean, it is only 75 minutes out of your week. But there's, it's almost kind of like what we were talking about with the European experience of like, but you are giving yourself this space also.
Oh, I think that's super important.
To do this work, you know, and to carve out that space. And when we get to a point where the symptomatic stuff is down, you still need to keep carving out the mm-hmm. space for yourself. This is part of the healing process, is actually mm-hmm. the space itself.
Yeah. We keep dancing around we haven't really got into this, the biopsychosocial model, as I understand it, mm-hmm. from the Noe group or David Butler. I mean, maybe those guys wouldn't even say it's their model anymore. I'm not sure exactly, but this idea of biopsychosocial, in a nutshell, so we have acute pain and chronic pain.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say, just for the sake of this argument or this discussion, because I'm not arguing with you, hopefully, See, I'm already conditioned that it's an argument. Shouldn't be. In this discussion, let's just say anything that, any pain that you've had for less than 12 months, let's call it acute.
Yeah.
Maybe there's still injury that's resolving. But more likely, if you've had pain longer than 12 months, it seems like there's a really good chance that the biology, the tissue piece where the original injury was, it's probably healed. But if you think about that premise of fire together, wire together, in the nervous system, mm-hmm. that it's the connections that were made potentially at the time of the injury or the event that maybe have, as they call it in the pain and biopsychosocial, they call it a neurotag or a mm-hmm. neuro. We talked earlier this idea of a groove or a record groove.
Yeah,
like the nervous system can kind of fall back into this pattern.
Yeah,
that can drive that experience of pain for further. And so, in order to break that or work with that, you have to, yes, maybe address the biology a little bit, which we can do on the table. But I introduce the ideas to people about, well, what's the stress level in your life like? Because physiologically, if you're really stressed, cortisol goes up. If cortisol goes up, your nerves become more sensitized, more sensitive.
Yeah.
So you might feel these things that are causing your nervous system to be more reactive again. So if you're really stressed, we got to you got to find ways to reduce the stress. I'll brainstorm that with you, but I can't do that for you.
Yeah.
What are the relationships in your life? Are they supportive or are they taxing? And again, I can't resolve those things for you, but we can at least drop the idea in for you. And so the biopsychosocial model would say that the biology is a piece to really help people who have this long-term chronic pain. You need to help them sleuth what other factors in their life might be contributing to this pattern of the neurotag getting stuck and saying, problem, threat, need to make a little bit of pain.
Yeah.
You need to do something. Because pain, what is pain? Pain is something our nervous system creates for us when it says, I'm not sure about something. I mean, when it's accurately, when there's like a broken leg, that's an accurate interpretation of a problem. But when that broken leg has been healed and you still have pain 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years later, there's a chance that there's a misinterpretation of information. And what pain is the nervous system saying, again, when your leg is broken and you have pain there, that's necessary to help you heal it. It says, change your behavior. Don't walk on this leg. But when that leg is healed and you still have ongoing pain, chances are there might be a way that the nervous system is misinterpreting information, thinking there's still a threat, trying to make you change behavior, but it doesn't need to change that behavior.
Yeah. I'm not sure how this fits into the model. Maybe this is
this is just
observations, but just over the years I've seen, you kind of brought it up a little bit, but I've seen also, let's say someone gets into a car accident around the time that their father died,
mm-hmm.
right? So you have these kind of commingling events,
mm-hmm.
and you know, maybe they have an injury in the car accident. It's not life threatening, but it's enough that it seems to linger and it's just not getting better.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, a couple of years later, they're just like, I can't seem to get my shoulder is just still.
Mm-hmm. You're totally explaining the biopsychosocial model.
Right. I've done MRIs and blah mm-hmm. blah blah. But I think there are these you know pieces that create that are anchors in that you know wiring you know and
it wires can, together it wires together
and you know so those are pieces together so you know and grief is one of those things that's mm-hmm. you know oftentimes you know it's there are waves of it it's not like a mm-hmm. constant thing. And so the pain is in the same kind of waves a lot
Absolutely.
Of time only it's harder to identify the grief. Yeah. And it is the pain because the pain.
Yeah,
is
you maybe thought you got over the grief,
right? Right.
But the pain is like right there, stabbing you in the shoulder.
Right.
It's right there,
and I do.
It's right in my shoulder.
I think being able to identify it is part of it, but there are different ways in, and I think you know, body work is an interesting thing. Like you've been saying, I don't always think that it's about the physical thing that. My model is that is helping mm-hmm. someone through a situation.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's my presence, you know, maybe that's enough even for some people. You know,
I think we live in a really touch starved society.
Yeah.
And I think people are really busy and a lot of, they're being pulled in so many directions, work, social life. And now we also have social media, which is just like, I mean, I catch myself. Mm-hmm. What did I do before I had a phone? I probably read a book or just relaxed. I let my brain relax. Now I go home, my kids go to sleep. My wife and I are cruising on our phones, Facebook.
Yeah.
So your brain's always working. I mean, it's just, so I think you're right. I think sometimes people might come to us and they say, I've got this going on and that going on. And they maybe do have those things going on. Not to say that's not real, but there's a deeper craving to just be seen, to be heard, to be touched, to be supported. And that's, I think that's also something that happens here. Yeah. And I don't think that's any less important. I think this, again, I alluded to the fact that I think therapeutic relationship is like, that's the foundation for the entire thing. Hmm. I think so. You got to hear people and then you can try to do some techniques on them. But if they don't feel heard, you don't have it.
Yeah. There's a great quote about that, about that it's like the most innate part of humans is basically just to be recognized. Mm-hmm. I mean,
yeah.
that simply.
Yeah.
And I think that's, it's, we wear so many different hats, whether it's, you know, for our family or for our job or for our children or, you know, whatever it is we're not necessarily recognized as wholes to everybody. And I think mm-hmm. when someone actually comes into one of our spaces and gets to be acknowledged that way and gets to express all of those things, it can, I think, change their, you know, their nervous system, even their physiology.
I agree with you with all that you just said. And I think there's also like, a physiological or a neuroscience pattern that could also explain it.
Yeah.
When you were a baby and you cried, did your mom or dad come and pick you up?
Yeah.
They touched you. And what happened to you? In your little nervous system, oxytocin flooded your system. You felt safe and you felt calm. And they put you back in bed. And they did that over and over and over again all through your life until you left the house in one way or another.
Yeah.
So when people come on our table,
if you were lucky, right?
No, absolutely. If you're lucky and you had that, you know, nobody has a perfect relationship with their family, but if you had supportive and nurturing family, that was your story. And so for a lot of people, I believe that response still happens. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, they've shown if you get an hour of body work, they've done blood testing, hormonal testing, do a blood draw before, cortisol's at a certain level, they do an hour of touch massage, you know, touch therapy, some sort of mental therapy massage, and after an hour, cortisol has dropped, oxytocin and testosterone go up. So I do think that there's an argument that whether or not someone knows that's what they're needing or craving or coming to, they're getting that.
Yeah.
And that feels restorative and it feels important. And then you can make the argument that on a physiological level, if we get cortisol to drop, we know cortisol is inflaming, you know, oxytocin can help us heal and starts a different kind of pattern of things happening in the body that can be restorative.
Yeah.
And if we can be a piece of that through, I mean, as simple as that, you know, I think that's probably what we get so frustrated before. It's like, I think it's human nature to just overcomplicate everything.
Yeah.
I touch you. It feels nice. It does something good for you.
Yeah.
I don't have to decide whether necessarily it's fascia or this or that or this or that.
Yep.
If I can be a safe, good presence, I can listen, I can brainstorm with you about how to feel better, about why you might not be, and then add that touch piece. I mean, that's pretty profound. I would love to know more exactly, but you don't always know.
Yeah.
And I try to read a lot of studies about it. And I talk to my clients as best as I can from that lens. But I also want to just also say I don't shut the door on the sort of mystical side too of that happens because
absolutely.
You've had too many weird experiences of just big shifts happening that you wouldn't expect. And I don't know how to explain it from the science I read or this or that either. So, you know, it's somewhere in the middle and that's what's so strange about.
It's relationships too. It's that you know, there are so many of these, like, I love the simplicity part of what you're talking about, mm-hmm. because it starts with that. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that's a building block of mm-hmm. like, touch makes me feel better. It releases all these things. Mm-hmm. We know that we're super dynamic creatures. And so we also need to sometimes make sense of this or have someone to talk through some of this mm-hmm. stuff with, which is what we also kind of can do for them. Mm-hmm. And that's another part of that relationship. And you're a lot of times listening more than you're doing anything else, because you're really trying to like figure out, what does this person need in terms of support here? And mm-hmm. you know, maybe, you know, knowing that if you're going to give them direction, it's gotta be also very simple. Like I have kind of a rule that I if I'm doing some kind of work with people, I never give them more than three things to do.
No, the stuff I give them to do at home takes like 20 seconds.
Yeah.
Because again, I don't want to be an extra burden.
Exactly.
It needs to keep it something manageable and interesting that, what would it be like if I tried that? Oh, that was easy. And I did feel something different.
Yeah.
And it's important.
So, do you have any rituals for yourself that you do, like health rituals and anything that you kind of help to keep yourself balanced?
I get lots of hugs from my two kids.
Yeah.
Right now it's like my wife would laugh at me because we've been together for a good number of years, over 10 years. And, you know, I used to be a national team athlete, super fit. And since my wife's known me, I'm like, I need to start running again. And I don't. I go in spurts. And so, yeah, I'm always like, oh, I need to take care of myself better. I used to love, I used to swap people and trade people body work. But sometimes I don't like that either. I'd rather just maybe pay, because then I can just show up and just experience. Way. I don't have to feel about exchanging back. But yeah, no, right now, I mean, what I like to do is, I cook a lot of good food. I garden. I play clawhammer banjo. I'm lucky that I'm in this practice building stage again, having just moved back from San Francisco. So I have a good amount of clients, but I still have time. So I take care of my kids. And that's when I get the aforementioned hugs.
Yeah, the oxytocin.
Yeah, I get my oxytocin boost, exactly.
It's the best.
Yeah.
Do you have a working definition of health that you try to use with, like, when you're, you know, trying to help someone figure out what that place might be for mm-hmm. them if they feel like they're really out of balance, or for yourself?
I mean, I guess I don't know if I would say I've like decided here's my working definition of health, but what I think about is sometimes I think people, especially because I do see a good number of people with chronic pain or with ongoing pain, and I think a lot of times people think it's all or nothing. Like either I have pain or I don't have any pain. And I try to help people understand, like, well, as a professor in art school called it, we have these meat puppet bodies and they are prone to having discomfort. So the question is, what are the things that you want to do? And how do we get you to the place where you feel you can do that? And that may not mean that you have zero pain, but hopefully you have less pain or you're relating differently to your pain. And if you're otherwise able to go along your life and do the things you want to do, that's probably a good picture of health.
Yeah. If you're not so distracted by whether it's, you know,
you're able to think thoughts about, like, wow, it's a blue sky today. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Because I think for people who have tons and tons of pain, it's hard to find those minutes. Knock on wood, I don't have that experience, so I only have to guess at what that's like. But, you know, I think that to me would be health. Like, you're able to sort of live under your own agency and do the majority of things that you'd like to do. And your body allows and facilitates that. And your brain and your body are sort of working together. So something like along those lines. wasn't so eloquent, but
no. I like to get these things because I feel like it's changing all the time. Like I could ask you this question in a week and you might give me, you might add some little piece to it or say, you know, I had this experience that I think this is actually something that's really important. That's part of this. So I think we could answer this a million different ways, but I actually really like that sense of, we almost kind of all need to kind of, and I use this a lot of time with my people as a means of getting people motivated for themselves. If they've been struggling with chronic pain or some kind of dysfunction for some period of time.
Just even relating to their bodies. I get a lot of people just like, I don't feel myself the way I used to feel.
Yeah. So I'll choose something that's like their passion and say like, you know, let's use that as a gauge maybe.
I ask them, what aren't you doing that you want to try to do?
And then we can keep checking in with that thing and say, you know, if what you want to do is, you know, play guitar or, you know, go on bike rides with your kids or whatever it is, then we have this marker that we can kind of keep going back to and saying, have you been able to, you know, do any biking lately? And, you know, you hear back, oh yeah, it's great. I didn't feel bad. I actually felt a little better afterwards or, you know, because I think we also can if we've been in a place, I've had some chronic pain, so I kind of know a little bit more, but you can get to a point where you start to identify as a person with it.
Oh, absolutely. I see that with my clients for sure.
And then it becomes the focus, not only of, you know, for yourself because you're feeling it or because, you know, it's something that you're aware of when you feel it. And so you kind of keep saying, you know, I'm in pain. But everyone starts to relate to you then, who knows that you're struggling, or every therapist that you talk to, also that person with pain. And I think you can become this other person who, you know, likes to cycle.
And might still have some pain. At times, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I think that's a really important piece, is that our story does become a part of how we relate to ourselves and our pain. So when we have chronic pain for maybe, again, use it in this discussion, a year or longer, you know, there's a lot of emotion around that. What's wrong with me? Is it broken?
Yeah.
And I should take care of it. I shouldn't use it. So we start to use our body less and less sometimes. I've seen this pattern at least a lot with clients. And because we are taught to believe that if we have pain, it means that there's probably a problem or there's damage. And there's a lot of studies that are starting to look at the correlation between pain and, again, damage or all stuff. And it's not a one-to-one correlation.
Mm-hmm.
And so one thing we find is like, maybe actually by going and doing something, if you like biking, even if you have a little pain, try biking a little bit. See what that feels like. You don't have to go for 100 miler right away.
Yeah.
Go for 2 miles, go around the block. But the movement can clarify body map. It can get oxytocin pumped up.
Yeah.
It can raise endorphins. It can change your personal narrative about your capabilities. And all those constellations go back to, it's a different input. So you might get a different output.
Yeah.
But if you just keep doing the same thing and you keep sitting with the fear or the worry or the resentment or the anger towards the pain or to the thing, and you're not moving and you're just going to kind of be there, you know? And so I always encourage clients, look, try to do a little movement, try to do a little bit of what you want to do.
Yeah.
See how that shifts it.
First steps.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, I heard someone talk about why so many adults stop learning how to play a musical instrument.
Hmm.
And they said basically it's because they have super unrealistic expectations.
Yeah.
A little kid doesn't care either way.
Yeah.
They make horrible sounds and they think it's fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, an adult can't learn all of the chords on their instrument and they stop.
Yeah.
That's unrealistic. You only need 3 chords for most songs.
Yeah.
And it's the same for people with pain. I don't think that you should expect to like have pain one day and then suddenly have zero pain the next day.
Yeah.
And be able to absolutely do every activity that you want to do.
Yeah.
Hopefully you can start to do that. And you have to do something different. Different input, different output.
Yeah. And I think we became, you know, overly reliant on Western medicine, and it's Western medicine is amazing. Yeah. Really, we have to the fact that we've figured out as much as we have in the last 100 years or less, mm-hmm. is incredible. Mm-hmm. But it kind of took us out of the equation a little bit in terms of
totally disempowering.
Yeah, exactly.
I tell people a lot, if I'm in a car accident and I have limbs hanging up, bring me to the emergency room. That's where I should be. If I want to maybe be more preventative with nutrition, or then there's different avenues to get different information. There's other, and I just think it's worth trying to educate yourself.
Yeah,
yourself.
I do it because I had this chronic pain period. I've kind of gone in and even had some workups from time to time. I have someone that I've worked with for a while, who has said check in with it every 5 or 7 years or so, and let's just monitor it. Only if you feel like things aren't feeling great, let's just look at it again. Sometimes, because it was really an issue with my spine, mm-hmm. that is probably not going to go away. Knock on wood here. I've been good for 22 years. So that's a pretty amazing thing.
And biopsychosocial.
And biopsychosocial.
You've probably learned how to handle your story differently. I mean, there's a lot of...
Absolutely. Ways. And you could look at me structurally in an MRI or X-ray and find a lot of stuff, let me tell you.
Well...
but I think...
That's another point we haven't talked about yet.
I think I could... It's a tool. It's just mm-hmm. another tool. And I find it... I have some this full body scan that was done of me when I was 27 years old that I've taken to a bunch of different things, and it's interesting to have that now. When I every once in a while, if I'm working with somebody new, I'll say, I had this problem. I have this full body X-ray. Mm-hmm. They did measurements of my bones. We did mm-hmm. all these different things. They are what they are. If you'd like to look at it, you can check it out. And mm-hmm. people are so curious, as I was. And I think...
You mean physicians, or you mean...
If I've worked with an orthopedist or PT somebody over time, because I want them to kind of get, what they get with their hands. But there's also this other tool, which they can, this scan that they can look at and be like, oh, this is really interesting. Mm-hmm. You at 27 years old, mm-hmm. right? So we have... that part of things, which has developed out of, this scientific tradition, that's also pretty incredible. Sometimes blows me away.
It is incredible, but I'm just going to drop this into the mix. I mean, I'm not advocating in any way that people should not get MRIs or should not get X-rays, but you can find there's a good number of studies that are they're trying to say, how do we know that the things that are showing up on these imaging techniques are always the cause of someone's pain?
Is it just like we don't know whether or not we're affecting fascia?
Exactly. I can't say that I'm changing fascia or nervous system.
Yeah.
And the studies that I talk to clients about, and it's not to say that imaging is bad or wrong.
Right.
But when you have someone who has chronic pain and has imaging that hasn't shown anything abnormal, then I always like to tell this about these studies, that there's a good number that have been done that they said, well, who gets imaging done in general? People who have pain. Because people who have pain go to the doctor. So the doctor is not, in general, prescribing imaging to be done on people who do not have pain. Mm-hmm. So there's a handful of studies that... started looking at the spines of people who are asymptomatic for back pain, no back pain.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found was herniated discs.
They're also a mess. Right?
Facet joint aberrations. Yeah, yeah. And in fact, in this study of people who had no back pain, 100% of the 80-year-olds had multiple cervical disc bulging, bulges.
Yeah.
And they didn't have pain. So that's not to say that disc bulges don't cause pain, but it's just saying they don't always cause pain.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's really important for a lot of these people to hear, in my opinion, who come with chronic pain.
Yeah.
Because it can help say, look, I'm not just making this up. There are studies I can direct you to that you can find that will show you that just because you've seen this doesn't mean that that is causative.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people who actually have back pain, and when you x-ray their back, it looks like super healthy. So that again, to me, just points the needle a little bit towards this. There's a nervous system component.
Yeah.
Like maybe some people are more sensitized to feel things or more sensitive, and so it takes less to have them interpret something as pain. Other people are able to lumber on and not be able to be phased. And what I find by telling people about these studies is that it often can kind of be the key that offers some hope and cracks open the door to let them say, gosh, I have this pain, but I've had it for a long time, so maybe I should try to move a little bit through it. And what happens?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, they move through it, and it starts to get a little bit less. And then it starts to...
And I actually think that the model is shifting. And I think there are, I mean, just from my experience, I tore my Achilles tendon four years ago. So that was a pretty big deal.
Ouch.
And, you know, from that experience, and just I've done a lot of, you know, work with people with like hip and shoulder stuff,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, I find more orthopedic surgeons and PTs willing to entertain the fact that surgery is not going to answer, or it's not going to solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's cool.
And I, compared to, you know, the earlier part of my career where I was seeing laminectomy after laminectomy.
Yeah.
And
I don't see that many of those actually right now.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, and again, you know, there are trends, there are these things that, well, once it, you know, makes a medical journal or in the New York Times or whatever, it's like suddenly it's in the zeitgeist and now everybody has this thing, right?
Well, there's studies that have been done on, I'd have to look it up for you, but I know I read it, sham knee surgeries.
Mm-hmm.
Looking, you know, so double blind people come in and you either got the real surgery or you didn't. They went through the whole procedure as if.
Oh, I've heard about this study.
They were opening up the cements. They were opening up the solvent or whatever. They're using the equipment to. Yeah. So the person at the table assumed that they were always getting it. And they had people who received the, quote, sham surgeries,
mm-hmm.
who came in wheelchairs and walked out under their own power. How do you explain that?
Yeah.
So... again, I mean, it's cool that it's cool that maybe there is a rethinking, like, okay, well, how is this working? And I mean, at least we just, you know, we don't cut anybody, you know, but I think there's a similar mechanism at play.
And it's placebo effect that no one wants to talk about, which is, I think I've mentioned this before, but Upledger has a great quote about, you know, Dr. Upledger, who started the craniosacral method, but he had this great quote about, someone asked him in a course, in, you know, sort of medical
symposium
conference. Yeah. And said, well, how much of this do you believe is placebo?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, that basically placebo is just an indicator of our own, you know, creative ability to heal ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, and on all those different levels. So these kinds of things, I think, blow people away, and it's mystical, but one of the things that I always kind of remind my, you know, clientele is that I'm only because again, back to the guru thing that we talked about earlier, they really want to say like, you healed me, you know, and what I try to kind of get them to understand is that I'm tapping into this innate healing mechanism, which is both physiological, you know, spiritual, emotional, all these different components that you are also, you know, that you naturally have and that you can tap.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes it's like very consciously and sometimes it's unconscious. And
absolutely.
it's a huge field of medicine that will, and why we don't quite understand and why this conversation has gone on for so long is we don't quite understand it all.
Yeah. No, I mean, I thought about bringing placebo in a few times in the conversation because, I mean, I was like, should I talk about it or not? But I feel like a big piece of what happens in here is really placebo.
Yeah.
No, everybody listening, don't think that like, you know, nothing happens. No. Like Jeremy just said, it's, to me, I think placebo, if you can elicit a placebo response, it's like one of the highest medicine.
You've done your job somehow.
And I'm not trying to put myself at top of pedestal of all medicine. It's not that at all. Like all medicines, all modalities, if you can elicit a placebo response, that's not something we should like be running away from.
Yeah.
That's something we should be running to. And if we can help our clients shift their pattern of pain, and by touching them and setting a good context, being great listeners, you know, strategizing with them about how to shift their life, and it aligns just right to allow a placebo response to happen, or elicits it, or I'm not even sure how it happens, but if that happens, that's awesome. That's like the best outcome. And I don't think it's because, I do think it has to do, it is placebo. I mean, I call it placebo.
Yeah. Well, I think we got it figured out.
Yeah, that's it. Can I give one plug for a website that I don't get any kickbacks from this, but we've talked about a bunch of things here quick in this
yeah, segment, yeah.
Like body maps, chronic pain stuff. There's a free resource that I tell all my clients who come to see me to check out. It takes about 15 minutes to look at. It's really useful at kind of breaking this down and explaining, because understanding how chronic pain works through the biopsychosocial model of pain, which to me seems like the most likely at this point in time with our knowledge that we know, accurate understanding of like probably what's happening with pain. It takes a little leap of faith to say, that's different than I believed about myself and about my body. And so to break it down piece by piece and in like a sort of PowerPoint presentation, this website does that, and it takes you about 15 minutes to go through it. And the cool thing about this is the research that the NOE group in Australia is doing shows that even by getting this education, people have a positive self-reporting in a decrease in their pain levels. Okay, so here's the website. It's called retrainpain.org.
Okay.
It's that is put on by a group in New York. I think they're physical therapists. And like I said, I don't get any kickbacks from it. I just think it's a great resource for people with chronic pain.
Absolutely.
The other things to look up would be look up the Neuro Orthopedic Institute in Australia, either David Butler or Lorimer Mosley. They are pain researchers and just doing really cool work to help people who have chronic pain learn more and shift it and get out of pain. And you can find tons of YouTube videos for those guys.
Yeah, and I think some of it is changing your belief system. I can't tell you how many people have come into my office and they're working on very, you know, minor things, you know, sort of compared to where they were sometimes. And they'll tell me, I had chronic back pain for years. I read the Sarno book.
Yeah.
I mean, have you heard this?
Oh, yeah.
And I've actually never read it. I feel
it's
like
all about your work.
I know enough about it that I just haven't dug into it.
I haven't read it either, but it's
been around me, swirling around me. I'll probably have to sit down and read it at some point. But it's another example of you know what we can sort of do by changing that belief system too, the rewiring.
It's everywhere. It's you know, Western society. It's a reductionist. You know, you're brought up thinking about our body in reductionist terms. Here's my finger, here's my arm, here's my big toe, here's my stomach. Well, yeah, in some ways that's useful to think about it that way. But really, our brain is continuous to every nerve, and every nerve goes every place in our body. It's just like we talked about at the beginning. I turn to that one plate in that anatomy book, and the human form is completely covered in yellow. Nerves everywhere. So to me, what that really says is that there's no way to separate our brain, our mind, from any other part of our body.
Right.
It's all there, always. And when in the context of what our work, we have to acknowledge we're always working with it.
Yeah,
we're not breaking it into pieces. We're working with the whole person as best we can in our limited modality and skill.
Yeah. Thanks for doing this, man. This is great.
Yeah.
Such great resource really for people. And thank you for sharing some of the things that these other things that you've been leading people to. Mm-hmm. We'll throw them up on the website.
Yeah. And they're really useful tools.
And do you have any place of resource, a website or anything that you have to share?
My website is rolfingminneapolis.net.
Okay. So if anyone's looking for some mm-hmm. physical support or beyond.
Even if you don't live here and you have questions, or you're not interested in actually coming to my office, but you have a question, just email me. I'll, as best as I can, I'll answer your questions. And the whole point of this is just helping people out and trying to be a good resource.
Yeah, man. Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks so much.
Yeah, you bet. Thank you, Jeremy. Really enjoyed it.
Grant Earnhardt, folks. What I really like about Grant's perspective is his use of a very westernized model, but acknowledging that we are complicated creatures living within a world with many different forces and a lot of unknowns. And when it comes to chronic pain or the recovery of an injury, this therapeutic relationship often allows for the more subtle underlying things to move through the nervous system. As Grant suggests, we are not always working with what we think we are, and we may not ever know exactly how the healing happens. There's more and more scientific evidence to support our theories, but there's also the innate healing regenerating mechanism that is just built into us that may always remain a mystery. And because pain brings with it the relationship to our mental, emotional, and spiritual aspects, we are never just dealing with a physical pain issue. As we discussed, sometimes the nervous system or perhaps our unconscious will choose to use this pain period to address longer, more deeply held patterns of painful existential experience. And that could relate to our relationships, our jobs, our passions, and anything that we're struggling to move through. This can often come as a big surprise to the pain sufferer, and for sure feels like a huge drag at the time. But in my therapeutic and personal experience, it's often been a way of ensuring that we become more aware and stay in that awareness. And with that awareness, people often go through big life shifts in positive ways. I hope you enjoyed this topic. Let me know if you have any questions or are looking for a referral for yourself. I'm always available by email, jeremy@highwaytohealthpodcast.com. Thanks for listening and continued support of this podcast. Be good to yourself, be kind to each other, and take care of your planet. Be well, my friends.